From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg, and this is a Studio 2 Extra. Today, we're joined by Pulitzer Prize and Emmy Award-winning journalist Tremaine Lee. For more than two decades, he's been on the front lines of America's defining stories, from Hurricane Katrina to Ferguson to the killing of Trayvon Martin, and now in his first book, A Thousand Ways to Die, The True Cost of Violence on Black Life in America, he turns the lens inward, tracing how generations of violence have shaped his own family and the communities that he's covered. Tremaine Lee, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor and a privilege and a pleasure. So thank you.
I want to jump right into the book. And you begin your book talking about your own heart attack at just 38 years old. And I have to ask you, why did you decide to start the book with that moment?
The heart attack, in so many ways, was the start of a new life for me. It reshaped how I thought about living and my own family and my career, but it also reshaped the book that I was writing. For 2 years before the heart attack, I was writing a book about the true cost of gun violence in this country in terms of actual dollars as a way to get to the cost that we pay as families every single day in communities. But then when I had the heart attack, my six-year-old daughter at the time, who's 13 now, she was asking me, "Daddy, you know, how'd you almost die? What happened?" And to give her the most honest answer I could, I had to really look within and be vulnerable and be honest and look at the weight of what I've been carrying. For more than a decade and some change, I've been telling stories of Black death and survival. And even here in this city where I started in Philadelphia, I can remember arriving at crime scenes and seeing young men dead who were my age. Yeah. Look just like me, the same sneakers, same haircut, and seeing the same pain in his family's eyes that I can only imagine would be in my family's eyes. And I had to look at our family history, going back more than 100 years to the Jim Crow South, the first murder in our family that sent us from the Jim Crow South into New Jersey. And time and again, it happened over and over. And wrestling with the psychic weight of that and what it means to carry that, inherit that. And so those two things together, it just changed the book I was writing completely. And I figured we have to start where the new foundation of this work begins.
Yeah, because that moment, I mean, you had been carrying this. And I think people don't realize that as journalists, as storytellers, covering tough things like gun violence and death and tragedy, it takes its toll on you, your physical bones, your physical body.
It weighs on you in ways that we just pretend it doesn't. And so what a lot of journalists do, and you'll know this, they either have dark humor.
Yeah.
Maybe you'll turn to drinking. A lot of reporters, we drink a lot, right? Or we throw ourselves headlong into the work even further and never fully addressing what it means as they're trying to put shape to life and death, what it means to have those jagged pieces in your hands. Mm-hmm. What does it mean to see a dead body, somebody shot in the head? What does it mean? Yeah. What does it mean to have to deal with the weight of the grief of their family members? What does that mean every single day? One day it's a fire and three people are killed. One day it's a shooting, right? And we're never given the tools, even those of us who are great at our jobs, to articulate the story and write the story, never given the tools fully to break it all down. And so that that weathering that we experience from time and again, it takes a personal toll, and it can manifest not just mentally and emotionally, but physically.
Physically. And I would like for you to read a selection from your book.
Thank you. When Nola asked if I almost died from my heart attack, I hesitantly said yes. I made a promise to her when she was still in the womb that I'd always tell her the truth. My answer, that the heart attack almost killed me, left her silent for a long moment. "But how?" she asked. "How did you almost die?" I wanted to tell her that for far too long, I'd taken all that I'd seen as a reporter and all the terrible things that came before me, before us, and buried it down deep until the weight became so great that my heart simply couldn't bear it. That it all began long before that day with a really, really bad thing that happened to our family back down south. And in so many ways, long before that. But I'm still trying to figure out how much truth a little girl needs. When my heart attack happened, I was writing a book on the many costs of gun violence. For years, I sat soul deep in people's suffering. I traveled across the country talking with survivors of gun violence, trauma surgeons, therapists, activists, cops, and frontline workers in the trenches of the fight to save lives. I was searching for the untenable cost of gun violence in actual dollars, lost lives, and stolen dreams. yet I had little idea just how costly this work would be. The chapters of this book almost became the final chapters of my life. This book almost killed me.
How did you come to recognize the toll that this work was taking on you?
I want to say the heart attack. That's when I realized.
So before that, you had no real idea.
I couldn't really recognize it. Before the heart attack, I often dealt with sleeplessness.
Yeah.
My stress lives in my sleep. It won't necessarily live in the way I deal with you as a friend or my family. I don't, my character doesn't change much. I don't feel sad often. I don't get angry. I'm normally pretty steady. I'm the same person most of the time, but I couldn't sleep. And I would be thinking about the interviews and the stories and the stress of how do I, you know, craft these stories in a humane way? How do I tell? So I would just do that at night. And so I would take those over-the-counter medicines to try to sleep, melatonin. I would drink. I would do all kind of stuff. But I never fully put my finger on what it was that was making all of the noise.
Mm-hmm.
When the heart attack happened and I had to wrestle with Nola's question about how and why, I came to understand that blood clots and bullets are different things. But as I write, both can twist and shred a life. That there is this violence, a silent violence sometimes inside of us that we carry, right? That breaks us sometimes or threatens to break us. And so what was bearing down on my heart, the death, was really, in my understanding, the stress of it all, right? And I've always considered myself mission-driven. That was my North Star, is to tell the people's story and shine light in dark spaces. But again, all of that was bearing down on my heart.
Yeah, and the thing is, as a journalist, you've called yourself a griot. Why do you think you were drawn to those types of stories? Because you could have been writing about anything, Tremaine.
Yeah.
You're a gifted writer. You didn't have to cover death. You didn't have to cover tragedy. Why were you drawn to that?
Our stories and our narratives matter. And I think in telling the stories of the harder parts of our experience here in this country, it helps us understand this country, how we've existed, how we've moved, how we've been bound by it all. And the sparks of American violence are at the core of what this country is. And we've weathered and experienced that more than most. But in an actual way, it started here in Philly. I'm from South Jersey, across the bridge.
Yeah.
And I can remember as a kid watching the MOVE bombing on the news. Mm-hmm. And I might have been 7 or 8 years old. And I remember seeing the fire and the flames and the survivors. And even though I didn't have the knowledge or context or understanding to articulate what was going on, I knew something was deeply unsettling and deeply wrong with what I was seeing. And my mother raised me to see the beauty and pride and strength in us, and to see that chipped away at, to see that disrespected, to see that sometimes burnt and killed in people. It sparked something in me. I wanted to tell these stories. But also, I too didn't necessarily think it would take the shape it did. My first and only internship at the Philadelphia Daily News.
Yeah.
I really thought I was going to be like Richard Wright doing feature stories about black people. And then I was put on the city beat and the police beat. And I ended up in North Philly seeing those young men who looked just like me. And I had to grapple with it. And it was hard at first, but I realized in capturing sometimes the final moments of people's lives and how they remembered and how they experienced life as they lived, I could shine a light again on that bigger experience.
And you mentioned a young man in your book named Kevin, who you just always thought about. And you met him when you were an intern at the Philadelphia Daily News. Tell us about Kevin and what stood out to him and why throughout your entire career, he's someone, a character in your mind, a person in your mind that constantly kept coming back up for you.
Kevin Johnson is the reason this book exists. He really is. When I was an intern at the Daily News, covering the police beat, I heard of this young man who was shot in Southwest Philly. He was being robbed for his Allen Iverson jersey, shot in the back of the neck by a group of teenagers, and he was paralyzed from the neck down. And I made my way into his hospital room, and what I was expecting to find was a young man broken, completely broken. What I found in some ways was true, in some ways completely different than what I expected. He physically was broken. He couldn't move from his neck down. But I found a young man who was buoyant and full of life and smiling and hopeful, and told me about his dreams of walking one day and his literal dreams of playing basketball, and he's on the court and he's moving, and he said he could feel every single thing, every movement. And it struck me because I can't imagine how any of us would be in that situation. And I looked across his hospital bed and I found tears in his mother's eyes. And we both recognized in that moment that his dreams would never come true. He was going to be bound to a wheelchair and bound to a machine to keep him alive. But soon after that, she started talking about the cost it was going to take to just get him home. They would need a special wheelchair.
$35,000.
A special van.
Yes.
A ramp for their row home. Mm. The doors would need to be widened. They would need new outlets to keep his breathing machine going. And I said, you know what? In that moment, I never fully considered the financial burden and cost of gun violence. But I said, you know what? People might not care. A lot of people won't care about Kevin Johnson or Kevin Johnson in the world. So maybe if I tell the story of how we're all paying a price for it, that I can then lure people close enough to tell the story of what's really the highest price, which is a young man's dreams and his mobility and his life.
Yeah.
And so I started telling that story, and I was trying to tell that story for years and years, from every newspaper I went to everywhere I went. I was trying to tell the story of the cost, and I couldn't get it done until finally I wrestled it into a book pitch that became the predecessor to this book, which was called Million Dollar Bullets. Yeah. And that was the original concept of the book, trailing the cost. Then the heart attack happened and changed everything.
And then A Thousand Ways to Die.
But I never forgot about Kevin, though. I never forgot about him.
Yeah, and Kevin, by the way, passed away a few years later. But his hope definitely was something that seemed to stand out to you. I want to talk about your life, because to me, I wondered if, given the history that you have in your, you know, the generations of your family that have been affected by gun violence, if that was something that you think might have drew you to these types of stories. Because if you go back to before you were even born, I think it was like your great uncle Cornelius killed by shot and killed in Georgia. That's before your family even came to this region of the country. He was just 12 years old.
Yeah. So when I was growing up, we always heard the story of my grandfather, Horace Worthington, who was shot and killed in 1976. My grandparents owned an apartment in Camden, and they were going to rent it out to a guy. So the guy leaves a deposit and disappears for many weeks. He comes back, want his money back, and my grandfather told him, you know, it was non-refundable, and I'll see you in court. He came back and murdered my grandfather, shot and killed him. That story loomed so large in my upbringing. The absence that my grandfather's death left on everyone was palpable. He was this big, strong, you know, everybody loved him.
He became like a superhero.
He was
in
like
your
a
family.
Superhero. Yeah. He was this towering figure. And so that one undoubtedly began to shape my earliest ideas of life and death and loss in a particular way. I couldn't even get my arms around him because I didn't know him. He was killed 2 years before I was born. But in the writing of the book is when I started to discover even more that the first killing in our family was 1922 in rural Jim Crow, Georgia. My great grandparents were tenant farmers at the time, meaning they worked land they'd never owned. And it was approaching settlement time in December, the time when the landowners, the white landowners, would rip you off. And they sent off my great uncle Cornelius, my grandmother's older brother, who was 12 at the time, to run errands. He ended up being shot and killed in a neighboring town called Fitzgerald. Now, Fitzgerald was a sundown town. My family joins the Great Migration shortly after that, ends up in Philly first and then South Jersey. And decades later, a state trooper killed another of my grandmother's brothers. He was only a teenager.
Clint. At 17 years old.
Clinton Woods, only 17 years old, under mysterious circumstances that are reminiscent of Mike Brown and Ferguson. And reading the newspaper accounts from the Courier, said, "Trooper's gun kills youth." Right? Like the gun just popped
up. No accountability.
Just the trooper's gun kills youth. And then, you know, 25 years after that, in 76, my grandfather is murdered. And then in 96, my stepbrother was shot and killed in Camden. So holding both of those things in my hands, that the stories that I was telling as a journalist of other families' pain, mostly black, and holding my own family's history and story, it's the most American of stories. The violence baked into this place, the violence that black people have experienced, whether it's white supremacists, whether it's the armed wing of the government, the police, or whether it's other people in the community, other black people. We've had to carry the weight of this violence and death. And so many of us are crumbling beneath that weight. But it certainly ain't nothing wrong with us, right? So it's important for us to engage with and examine all of the machinery built around us. And so certainly the way Black people have experienced not just the violence of the gun, but all of the systemic violence that precedes it. Yeah. The violence of segregation, the violence of having communities razed to the ground, right? The violence of having lack of access to quality health care and water, right? The air that we breathe, mm-hmm. all of these forms of violence that create the perfect ecosystem, a ripe ecosystem for us to experience all that other kind of gun violence.
Yeah, and that almost took you out because the weight of that, you were carrying it, and I think in a very different way by being the storyteller mm-hmm. And pieces of it glom onto you and you don't even realize it. And then you have your own family history. So what do you hope people take from the book?
For so many of us, when we turn on the news or read the newspaper and there's another young Black man shot and killed, sometimes even those of us who are Black or from these communities project onto them some sort of individual criminality or violence or something that's in them. So when I say this, it's not to take accountability away for actions that people take, the violence that people commit. But I think we need to understand that all this is kind of also a setup. The way we've been taught to expect a certain level of deprivation or violence or hunger and never have those needs addressed, that we live in communities that were cordoned off from the economic engines of the cities. And so the violence that we see, especially from young people who are feeling so unmoored from the violence that dislodged them long before they were ever born, that's the violence that we need to address first. Mm-hmm. If we address that violence, then we'll see less of that. Because when we see communities, Black communities included, that are well-fed, that are well-heeled, that have steady incomes, that have access to quality foods and vegetables, right? Those communities experience less violence.
Yeah.
But then you come to our communities, and it's like you can pile map on top of map on top of map of where the hunger is, and where the exposures to toxins are, and where it's the most dense, those places also experience the most gun violence.
Yeah. And so I think about the generations to come. I think about your daughter, who you wrote about throughout the book. And I want you to give a thread of hope as we wrap up.
You know, the reason why the pain hurts so badly, the reason why it's so tough, is because the joy is enormous. The love is enormous. Our family traditions, you can't even get your arms around it. And that's why the tears come. And that's why the pain comes, because there's so much promise and possibility, especially in our young people and folks who believe deeply in the sanctity of human life, that we should protect each other and love on each other. And what we've been able to build out of nowhere and out of no way. And that there are young people, my daughter included, who is now 13 and wants to be a journalist, right?
That's a beautiful thing. Listen, just like her dad.
Just like daddy, right? And that there is so much power in taking agency and stock. Mm-hmm. And in order for us to move forward, point to the dark parts, mm-hmm. point to the ugly parts, and let's break them down, right? Yeah. So we can move forward. And so I am actually very hopeful. Again, a lot of this book, it's a heavy read, but it's a necessary read. And to get to the sunshine, you got to push through the darkness, right? We have to. And so despite the weighty nature of it, I'm very proud. It's an honor and a privilege to tell the stories and humanize and recognize and lift up voices of folks who often suffer in silence.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Tremaine Lee, for being on Studio 2.
Thank you. A pleasure. Thank you.
That was Pulitzer Prize and Emmy Award-winning journalist Tremaine Lee, author of 1,000 Ways to Die. You can listen to Studio 2 live Monday through Thursdays at noon on WHYY 90.9 FM. Our show is produced by Debbie Builder and Andreas Copes. Al Banks engineered today's Studio 2 Extra. From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg. Thanks for listening.